Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. California is rolling out thousands of vaccination clinics across the state as eligibility expands to children 5 to 11. The lower dose version of the Pfizer vaccine was approved for emergency use authorization last week, and vaccinations began immediately. This comes as the state reports roughly 87% of eligible Californians have received at least one COVID shot. Now, this latest chapter in the pandemic also comes with questions for the youngest age group. Joining us to talk about the vaccine rollout to children 5 and older is California Secretary of Health and Human Services, Dr. Mark Galley. Dr. Galley, welcome back to Insight.
Hey, Vicky. Thanks for having me this morning.
Well, Dr. Galley, the state was initially allocated 1.2 million pediatric doses. 500 organizations received their initial shipments through yesterday. We're approaching roughly a week in. How many 5 to 11-year-olds have received their first dose?
We're roughly at about 74,000 5 to 11-year-olds across California as of last night that have been reported receiving one dose.
I understand that school districts and after-school programs are beginning to partner up with the state as this rollout expands. But we've been hearing anecdotally from some parent groups that finding an appointment has been difficult. I'm curious, just given that the infrastructure is already in place, what are the unique challenges to scaling up clinics for children 5 to 11?
Well, I mean, first off, we know that a lot of young people, children, as a pediatrician, father of four, you know, I try to get connected to the regular source of care. So for a lot of young people, it's getting into the provider that they want to administer the vaccine, that they want to get the questions answered from. So, I think in the days to come, we're going to see a number of new sites pop up, more pharmacies able to provide the vaccines, as well as those trusted pediatricians, family practice providers, and federally qualified health centers that have been doing it all along. Mm-hmm. So I think that any challenges that people have experienced, I think, will start to erode and go away in the days.
For parents who are interested in vaccinating their child now, should they initially go through their pediatrician, their physician, or go to offsite clinics?
I think both work. It really depends on what you're comfortable with. I think many people would like to go to their regular provider, which is a completely reasonable thing to do. I know as a primary care pediatrician, I always loved to be able to provide all of the care to the patients I had a connection and relationship with. So that might be what works for one family. And another family might say, I'm a block away from a Walgreens that's providing it Saturday morning. I'm going to go there. All of that works.
I was reading a Kaiser Family Foundation poll. They had surveyed parents leading up to this expected expansion to 5 to 11-year-olds, and they found that vaccinations for younger age groups have slowed. And when it came to parents with children 5 to 11 that were surveyed, it was pretty evenly divided into thirds. You know, about 27% were eager to get their child vaccinated. Another third wanted to wait and see. And then another third definitely said they will not get their child vaccinated. Those latter two amount to over 60%. So I guess just getting beyond talking points and the importance that you want to say about getting vaccinated, what are the unique challenges when it comes to outreach for the youngest age group?
Well, I think it's we've been from the beginning talking about how the vaccine is safe and effective. And I think we got to continue to get the data and the information out that it's not just safe and effective for older adults, but it's safe and effective even for the young kids. And the dose is different. So making sure people know that we're not just giving the same dose that we gave to a 45-year-old male to that 5-year-old. I have a 5-year-old daughter. I was happy to see that the dose was different. Knowing the way that we do dosing for pediatrics, it makes a lot of sense. So the communication of more information, and we've seen this throughout COVID with a little bit of time and people seeing their neighbors and their classmates getting vaccinated. I know that those numbers that you cited are going to change over the weeks and months to come.
We received some questions from listeners. They wanted to know what kind of clinical trials the vaccine went through for 5 to 11-year-olds and how or if they differed from other trials for older age groups.
Well, they differed in that, you know, the age of the young people were 5 to 11. They were very deliberate to try to reach out to all parts of the nation, all races, ethnic groups, to make sure that we had a representative sample. 4,000 plus young people in this age group went through the trial. They saw at the lower dose that it was a highly effective vaccine, and that the side effects, if you will, even the, you know, the day of, the day after side effects were tolerable, a little arm soreness, maybe some, low grade temperatures. But overall, the trial was a very robust one, and it came together because so many eager young people were interested in being part of the trial. It came together just as quickly as some of the adult trials. So I would say the material difference is it was a lower dose. They looked at the 5 to 11-year-old, but they saw the same thing that they saw in the adult trials, highly effective and safe vaccine.
Are there any more serious side effects that you want parents to consider or know about when they talk to their pediatrician and make a decision whether to vaccinate their child?
Well, I always think it's important to come in with your questions in hand, because as you know, some of those visits go very quickly. And by the time you leave the office, you wish you'd asked that one more question. So my advice is always write those down. But I also remind people with the 5 to 11, we've been so focused on this idea that young people are doing it for older Californians to keep their communities safe. I'll remind you that we've lost more kids to COVID than we have any other vaccine-preventable disease since the beginning of this pandemic. That's the first thing. The second thing is we are seeing the long-term impacts of COVID infection on kids, even though they don't have the worst outcomes, thank God, of significant numbers of hospitalizations and deaths as we saw in adults. We still see the consequences of long-term COVID, respiratory problems, neurologic problems, psychiatric problems that we want to make sure that we avoid by all costs. So this isn't just about the kids doing another great act for adults. This is about protecting the 5 to 11-year-olds first and foremost. And I want to make sure that all parents, all guardians, all 5 to 11-year-olds know this is really about protecting and supporting their health, not just the health of all Californians at large.
Well, then expanding upon that, what would you say to parents who believe that statistically kids only get mild forms of COVID, so the benefit of a vaccine is much lower than the risk of them having side effects from the vaccine?
Well, I mean, the truth is the side effects of the vaccine, if there are any, are very, very mild as well. And the consequences of actually getting the COVID infection are much greater for all of the things and the concerns that parents have around the side effects and the concern around inflammation of the heart and other challenges that I think have been well captured in the media. The truth is getting the disease of COVID can cause those same problems, but much, much worse and more frequently. So it is important to highlight that getting COVID, sometimes kids and people are lucky to avoid significant problems, but oftentimes it's not the case.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with California Health and Human Services Secretary Dr. Mark Galley about the vaccine rollout expansion to children 5 to 11. Well, California became the first state in the country to issue a vaccine requirement for students and staff, with exceptions, of course, and once the COVID vaccine or a COVID vaccine receives full approval for children. However, vaccine mandates, they're already taking place ahead of the state at individual school districts, including right here. Sac City Unified is among them. I mean, this does raise the issue of equity at a time when the Pfizer vaccine only has emergency use authorization for those 15 to 5 years old. Vaccination rates are relatively low among Latino and African American residents, including here in Sacramento County. Won't this continue to hurt the neighborhoods hardest hit during the pandemic when we're talking about education?
Well, I think we have to look at, Vicky, when we talk about public health, we think broadly. I think so many have focused public health on just COVID. But when we think about public health, and we've done this for centuries, we think about all things that impact individual and community's health. And education is part of it, the economy is part of it, and of course, the disease caused by COVID is part of it. And we know that the hard hit communities are the same ones you just mentioned. They've lost family members. They are the ones whose kids have been hospitalized more frequently, face the worst outcomes. And so as we move through these next many months and prepare to really get through the pandemic, what we know is the vaccine is what gets us through. The vaccine is what protects us from getting infected in the first place. Yes, people who are vaccinated do get infected, but we don't see them face the same consequences, either by hospitalization or deaths, or frankly, the long-term problems of COVID as well. So when I think about the equity challenges that we've been facing throughout this, and there have been many, and California has leaned in a tremendous way to make sure that we close gaps and really try to address the inequities that we've seen. Having kids and schools vaccinated, to me, is one of the strongest equity decisions that we can make. So I support school districts who are making decisions locally. I support what the state has done in looking at having a vaccine requirement in schools once full FDA approval is reached. And I think that we're going to see a number of families see the benefit of the vaccine and moving forward to make the decision for their own young people.
What do you say to parents that are okay with vaccines such as measles and mumps and tetanus, which are required within school districts, but they're more uncomfortable with the emergency use authorization piece of vaccinations for children 15 to 5 years old?
Well, I often say, first off, it's completely understandable to have questions and concerns. I mean, I have 4 kids. My wife and I sat down and we talked through the information and the data ourselves. Even though I and she live and breathe this, we had a very deliberate conversation and made the decision that it was the safe and effective things to do for our kids, not just our family, but for them. 5, 7, 11-year-old, we've all decided to have them vaccinated. So I think it's important to ask all of the questions that you have, get the answers so that you can make a good and well-informed decision. I often say, Vicky, also, that I have met many people who wish they'd gotten vaccinated, but because they either got sick themselves or lost a loved one because of an infection. But I've not met anyone who said, I wish I didn't get vaccinated after they'd been vaccinated. So I think on balance, we have a chance to really share information, get questions answered, and really support people in making a decision in advance of the mandates taking place. And that's certainly the best way to see it happen.
You know, vaccine hesitancy, a part of it is also tied to trust. And you're talking about closing gaps of inequity, especially when we're talking about underserved communities that have historically been felt or have been left behind and overlooked. And that's a crucial piece to overcoming skepticism in trusting a vaccine and not only vaccinating themselves now, but also making decisions for their children. So when we're talking about mandates, there is the argument that a mandate is a Band-Aid solution as opposed to addressing the heavier lift of historical inequities.
Sure, and I think that's where California has invested a great deal of time and resources in connecting to trusted messengers, whether that's the faith-based community, whether those are the schools, whether those are community organizations that have deep ties to specific communities. I often have talked about how this is really a block-by-block effort, that we need to go, and you've seen it, door knocking, a lot of communication, a lot of taking on hard questions. And that is frankly the only way that we get through some of this. Of course, there's people on day one who run to the front of the line and sign up, and we saw that in this state. But we predicted that there would be a time when we couldn't give the vaccine away. And we've run into that, and we have tried to take that on with every bit of energy and enthusiasm to answer and address questions that people have in the hopes that they will see the importance of getting vaccinated and decide to move forward. And we know we have a lot of work to do.
CalMatters and Mercury News in the Bay Area, they address this as well, going beyond school vaccine mandates. But the idea that whether these mandates will further hurt businesses, including students, that have low vaccination rates in their neighborhoods. What's your response to that? And is this still kind of a learning process for the state and public health officials?
Well, I've said from the beginning that California wants to be the state that learns the fastest during COVID, because, of course, we have seen so many opportunities to learn, so many things evolve in terms of our response. But I go back to the comment earlier, Vicky, on the equity issue. We've been working with businesses. We've been working with the ethnic chambers of commerce across the state to make sure that we're addressing issues of equity within the business community. We've been working on the same issues with students and school matriculation, trying to ensure that we're not missing an obvious opportunity to either communicate differently or roll out a policy in a more equitable way. And I think we stand by the concern that over the long run, we want to make sure that Brown and Black communities in particular that have been hardest hit by COVID throughout this entire pandemic, both get the benefit of the vaccine and have the protection of highly vaccinated communities and venues so that they can walk in confidently, not just as consumers, not just as workers, not just as business owners, but as parts of larger communities and families.
Last question was another one that we received from parents asking, after that statewide vaccine mandate goes into effect next summer, will masking requirements go away and will children return to more of a normal, uninterrupted schooling environment?
That's certainly our hope, Vicky. You know, the mask mandate, the mask requirement in schools right now is really in place because we've seen its impact and effect, and it's worked. It's kept California schools open at one of the highest rates since the beginning of the school year. Mm-hmm. We've had fewer outbreaks than other states have had. And we've had, I would say the school year has been a tremendous success from the perspective of getting kids back in person education, which we know was something they missed and lost out on in last year. So the assessment of where to go with masking is going to be one that is built around where the transmission rates are and how significant they are across the state. And one of the most effective ways to keep our transmission rates down is to get people vaccinated. So they go hand in hand. There's not a direct metric. There's not a magic number or a threshold of having people vaccinated. But getting vaccinated keeps our rates down. Keeping our rates down is going to help us get not just schools, but everything else back to what we all missed pre-pandemic.
Dr. Galley, thanks for joining us.
Vicky, thanks for having me. Take care.
And that is California Secretary of Health and Human Services, Dr. Mark Galley. Up next, our conversation with Lieutenant Governor Eleni Kounalakis on her trip to the UN Climate Change Conference in place of Governor Newsom. And we'll have a live conversation from Glasgow. Get a lay of the land from a first-time attendee. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The United Nations Climate Change Conference, or COP26, is nearing a close. This 26th year has included debates and protests from environmentalists, underwhelmed, to put it mildly, about the progress from this annual international high-profile climate summit beyond elitist elbow rubbing. Lieutenant Governor Eleni Kounoulakis returned from the summit last week after abruptly taking the place of Governor Gavin Newsom, who canceled his trip last minute due to unspecified family obligations. I spoke with the Lieutenant Governor yesterday about being thrust into the UN climate summit and how this trip will translate into tangible results Californians will actually feel and see. California touts itself as the fifth largest economy in the world. However, we are a state, a sub-nation. Can you just explain what role does California play in a global climate summit among other nations, including the United States?
Well, Vicky, that's a really good question. And that is the issue. So what we how we describe our engagement is sub-national. Right. So we may be the fifth largest economy in the world if we were a country, but we are not a country. We are a state within the United States. And there's no question that the U.S. presence at COP26 was very high profile. The president was there. John Kerry was there. Secretary Blinken was there. Gina McCarthy was there. So they had a very big presence. So what does California add? Well, here's what's really important, I think, for everybody in our state to know, that since the 1970s, we have had the ability to set our own emissions standards. This has given us almost sovereign power over something very important. And so as the climate issue has gotten, you know, more recognized as a real threat to all of the people around the world, we have been able in California, through, I might add, governors of both political parties, we have been able to ramp up our engagement with this big economy that we have, with 40 million people strong, to be able to actually drive policy that is important in the world. What do I mean by that? We have our 2045 goals of being carbon neutral. And of course, Governor Newsom just signed an order that by 2035, all the new cars sold in California need to be zero emission vehicles. That's huge. It's the first of its kind in the country. And already industry is responding. They're saying, well, all those people in California, and by the way, California is the biggest consumer market in the United States, right? This is where people are buying the cars. If they're going to have that rule, we better get ready to start delivering zero emission vehicles that are affordable and that people really want. So that's kind of the nature of California's very much outsized voice on this issue. And again, it was just a great privilege to be able to be there along with a huge California delegation to be able to deliver that message.
Well, despite California leading climate change in some aspects, you know, you mentioned banning gas-powered vehicles, cutting greenhouse gas emissions, renewable energy, but California is still the seventh largest producer of crude oil in the country. Regulating methane emissions from petroleum to agriculture is still a challenge, not to mention questions surrounding the amount of fracking in the state. Even the state auditor earlier this year reports California is not on track to meet those 2040 greenhouse emissions goal. And my point in all of this is, despite progress, there still are challenges. So what are the biggest climate hurdles to overcome, and how will attending a summit like this help overcome those hurdles?
So again, Vicky, you've really hit the nail on the head, because there's a great deal of pride that we could set these goals. But the bottom line is we have to be able to reach them, right? And to be fair, it's really fallen upon the Newsom administration to actually take the decisions that will move the dial. It's a different thing to set the goals versus what Governor Newsom has to do now, which is meet those goals. So we're getting closer to these deadlines. We have to really commit to action. And a big piece of that for this administration, and I'm really proud of the governor's leadership on this, is that we had this huge $75 billion budget surplus last year, and he has allocated $15 billion over 3 years to climate resiliency. That's everything from making it, you know, protecting us as best as we can with existing technology from wildfires, dealing with drought, but also billions of dollars to invest in the infrastructure for a clean energy future, fixing our grid, investing in charging stations, but also investing in the innovation that will help our universities and our public-private partnerships to drive the innovation that will allow us to scale up on things like solar and wind and battery technology. So there's still a lot to be concerned about, no question about it. And let me just say as well, you're absolutely right. We do produce oil in the state of California. People were keenly aware of that when we had this oil spill, a few oil leak a few months ago down off of the coast of Los Angeles. So we're very much in the middle of both dealing with the transition because of our history, dealing with the challenges that a warming climate is that we're facing. You know, 4% of the state of California burned last year from catastrophic wildfires, but also very much in the center of being able to drive the kinds of innovation and change that will allow us to deal with a problem that is extremely daunting.
Yeah, and we're talking about really tough conversations that are addressing climate change, but they're also tied to the economy. Yeah, how does the state balance climate goals with a potential cost to jobs and economic impact tied to industries which are a contributor to pollution?
Well, Vicki, let me just say from my experience growing up in California, I'm born and raised here, and I grew up in a very vibrant Greek American community in Sacramento. My father was an immigrant who started out as a farm worker, worked as a waiter, including as a waiter, by the way, in the governor's mansion. You know, jobs are sacred to the people who have them. And we absolutely have to think about that as we engage in this transition. But having said that, you know, it's a chicken and the egg that we have to drive and mandate the kinds of changes that will allow us to transition while we think about how to transition workers, retrain, upskill, and be very mindful of the families that the transition to clean energy can impact and will impact. Now, having said that, I will also say that we have reason to believe we can do it, because in California, over the last two decades, we have dramatically decreased our emissions in our state by about 10%, but we've grown our economy and we've increased the number of jobs. So again, we have to be mindful, because where you lose the jobs, where you gain the jobs, it's not going to be the same. And so we have to keep an eye on this. But it's also incumbent that we not just put our head in the sand and say change is too disruptive, so it's not possible. It's really a balance.
Even if California is relatively ambitious with climate goals, you know, climate change encompasses the world. Obviously, we don't live in a bubble. And while you were at that summit, climate protests were taking place simultaneously. I mean, the overarching message is talk is cheap and little tangible change comes from these formal ceremonial meetings. Given that you were there, sometimes taking the stage or with a front row seat, what do you say to that? Is there a role for these summits and California's place at these summits beyond pomp and circumstance?
Well, Vicki, I will tell you, part of me as a San Franciscan wanted to go out and join the protests, because we do need to wake up the world that we have to do this together. And, you know, it's quite notable that there were countries that were not present at COP. China was not present. We need to be able to engage with our partners in China on this issue. There are other countries that are lagging in terms of what their goals are, pushing back to 2060 and beyond the goals that the United States and European countries are pushing for 2050. So there's a lot of work to be done. And you're right. It can't be just us. It can't even be just the United States. It has to be the big economies of the world and the smaller economies of the world working together. So I think that if there's anything that categorized sort of the mood at COP is this isn't just the scientists anymore who are beseeching political leaders and people around the world to wake up. We see it with our own eyes now. Mm-hmm. And so what are we going to do? And will it be enough?
I mean, we're having this conversation when we're once again living through drought and mega wildfires. What did you take from your time at the summit that can be directly applied to climate initiatives here in the state, like actually results that Californians will feel and see?
Well, see, that is what's so interesting, is that the results that people will feel and see, they're going to feel and see in terms of technology in California first. About half of the electric vehicles on the road in the United States are on the roads in California. Our investment, I mentioned before, $15 billion in climate resiliency that the governor has put in to this year's budget. I mean, to give you an example, I was on a panel with the governor of Louisiana, and he said, well, gee, I was feeling really proud of our billion-dollar surplus in Louisiana until the lieutenant governor of California started talking about what's going on in California. But it's not just the size of that surplus. It's the commitment that Governor Newsom made to, and the legislature, by the way, 15 members of the legislature are in Glasgow right now. So the commitment to take such a large piece of it to invest. So what people are going to see in California are even more zero emission vehicles on the roads. What they're going to see is those rebates for solar panels and rebates for zero emission vehicles continuing to expand into communities that typically have not been the ones to participate. Because let's face it, you need the cash to be able to put a solar panel on your roof. You need the cash and the ability to buy a new car to be able to opt in for a zero emission vehicle and get that rebate. So using some of those funds to expand access to these programs, people are going to feel and see. And maybe the thing they won't see as much, but which I can tell you as lieutenant governor of this state, I see often, is what the private sector is doing. I go into manufacturing plants. I go into laboratories across the state where people are doing the work to develop battery technology, doing the work to figure out how to improve our electric grid, doing the work that we have been doing at the state level in engaging with countries up in Northern Europe that have made huge advancements in wind technology. And, you know, the governor just signed a bill I was very proud to be a co-sponsor of to expand offshore wind off of our coast. And by the way, people will hear about those. They're not going to see them because the ones that we're really looking to pursue will be tens of miles off the coast of California, not visible to people on the coast. But again, it requires, how do you build these things so that they can float because our continental shelf is so deep? So there's a lot of work being done. But what makes me feel proud to represent California and what makes me feel hopeful, even in light of all of the challenges ahead, is that California is a place where a great deal of innovation is happening that will allow us and allow the world to scale up. And, you know, Vicky, at least we've got that.
That is Lieutenant Governor Eleni Kounoulakis, who returned from the UN Climate Summit. Our conversation was recorded yesterday. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. All right, we're going to head to Glasgow, get a better picture of the lay of the land at the summit. Maris Densmore is based in Sacramento, attending COP26 for the first time with the American Carbon Registry. The nonprofit was founded in 1996 as the first private voluntary greenhouse gas registry in the world. Maris joins us now from Glasgow. Welcome to Insight.
Hi, Vicky. Got to be here.
Yeah, you've been there now for close to a week, and you're going to be round out the summit as a first-time attendee to this conference. And we're talking like thousands of people. What are your impressions?
You know, it's crazy. This is my first COP, and it's COP during COVID, and it's a COP after a year was missed, and it's been quite a year that was missed, and not just because of COVID, but really because of all the glaring warnings that we've been seeing about how drastically our climate is changing. So there's excitement to sort of get back to it. And there's a real feeling of urgency here to get back in action on climate.
You have such an interesting professional background. You're a geologist by trade, but prior to working for a nonprofit focused on reducing greenhouse gas emissions, you also worked in the oil industry. What led you down this career path?
It was not a straight path, for sure. And I joined the oil and gas industry at a time when there was a huge emphasis on the need for natural gas, and that was something that was going to really enable a lot of the transition in the country. And really, the transition to natural gas is responsible for a lot of the emissions reduction we've seen across the U.S. But change is needed, more is needed. And within the oil and gas industry, you know, there's lots of very smart people who want to see progress. And I wanted to move a little bit quicker, I think, than some of the folks that I was working with every day. And really happy to be at ACR and working on carbon capture and sequestration and plugging orphaned wells, because it's really where the oil and gas industry has the potential to contribute if they choose to make a progressive move in that direction.
You were actually moderating panels, and that was going to be my next question. Let's just dive into, you know, the wonkier but also very important issue of carbon capture and sequestration. How do you explain this to people without the background like yourself?
It's an odd one, because carbon capture and sequestration is really just about climate change. And no one is doing this for fun. And there's a lot of talk here at COP about biodiversity and reforestation and preservation. And those are all things that we can point to that have numerous benefits, climate benefits and other co-benefits. Whereas carbon capture and sequestration doesn't have that advantage. And what it is it's this suite of technologies that take CO2 either from the waste stream, from an industrial process, or even straight out of the atmosphere in direct air capture, and puts it into the ground, into a deep geologic reservoir. And these are generally reservoirs that have held oil or natural gas for millions of years. So we know it will stay down there, but it's a process to capture. It's a process to put it down there. And it's, you know, sort of tough to get that momentum across the world and in California.
Yeah, I guess when talking about that momentum, I'm just curious, what do you take away from the demonstrations and protests from environmentalists in Glasgow, frustrated with what they say are empty promises and stalled climate progress?
You know, I walked through the protest sort of in the morning when they were unfurling their banners and getting their flags out and warming up on their chants. And really, I hear it. And I hear it because we see the talk, but we don't see, you know, really a lot of action. And when, you know, the protesters, there were, I think, 100,000 people, and it was generally peaceful, but the urgency was there. And we really need an all of the above strategy. It's not just about, planting more trees. It's about doing absolutely everything that we can to tackle this, because we're there. So many of the conversations and the panels and the workshops and discussions were about resiliency and adaptation, because we're there. It's happening. And it's not just about prevention anymore. So you know, definitely engaging with the folks that are going to be more impacted by climate change. I learned today was Gender Day. at COP. Every day has a theme, and today was Gender Day. And I learned that 80% of the climate change refugees in the world are women and girls, and that women and girls are being disproportionately impacted by climate change, and something that's not out there maybe. So we do, we need action, but we're gonna have to make some really uncomfortable changes.
Last question, any advice for a first time attendee next year?
You know, good walking shoes, because the conference is big. You know, they cut us off this year at 10,000 people. So once the 10,000 number is hit, you have to wait to get inside. But there's so much to cover, and just jump in and learn new things. I learned more than I ever thought I could about krill. I learned about the cryosphere. It's an amazing opportunity to interface with people from all over the world and make some good connections. So if you have the opportunity to go, it's an amazing experience.
Maris, thanks for joining us, and safe travels back here to Sacramento.
Thanks, Vicki.
And that is Maris Densmore, based in Sacramento, but joining us live from Glasgow at the UN Climate Change Conference for the American Carbon Registry. That nonprofit was founded in 1996 as the first private voluntary greenhouse gas registry in the world. Still ahead, we preview the wonderful melodies of the Color of Music Festival, making their West Coast debut right here in Sacramento. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The Color of Music Festival is making its West Coast debut, and they're coming right here to Sacramento. Since 2013, the festival has brought together classically trained Black musicians to perform songs from composers of African descent. The overarching goal of the festival is to bring even more awareness to the contributions of Black composers to classical music. The Color of Music Festival will bring Sacramento four nights of solo recitals, piano, and vocal performances played by some of the top Black classical musicians in the United States. The first night of performances starts tomorrow and continues on through Saturday. Joining us now to tell us more about the festival is Lee Pringle, the founder and artistic director of the Color of Music Festival. Lee, welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the inception of the Color of Music Festival began in Charleston, South Carolina. Now it's going to include California's state capital. What drew you to the neighborhood of Oak Park, and specifically Oak Park's Guild Theater?
Well, you know, Charleston is considered to be the Ellis Island of those of African ancestry who came to the continent of North America. And as a result, it's almost a natural evolution that many of the things that were a part of that 1700 period of classical music getting its roots in the U.S., that the unique evolution of our country, and, you know, first being a place where we were enslaved, to grow to the point of getting beyond slavery, Jim Crow, Reconstruction period, to being able to create institutions that would support the things that we were not given access to. So I often say classical music is the last water fountain for those of us of African ancestry to really showcase how long we've been in it, and the fact that we're not only serious patrons, but we're serious artists. And, you know, I think, you know, migrating to the California coast is also natural because California has always been progressive. And we have a saying on the East Coast, so goes the way California goes, so goes the rest of the country. So really, former city council member Larry Carr, former council member Alan Warren, and currently Rick Jennings were the impetus for organizing this in early 2020. But of course, the global pandemic started and we had to push it back. So that's how we ended up getting here. The three Black council members at the time wanted this to be a part of the city's unique culture fiber. And we're just delighted to be here and to be on your show.
Yeah. And holding this festival in a historically Black community, Oak Park in Sacramento,
yes.
You already have some sold out performances. An all-female chamber orchestra is already sold out. But if people yes. are still itching to take all this in, what do you recommend and what are you looking forward to?
Well, you know, it's like a parent being asked to say which child is the most brilliant. I will say this, I'm just honored to be in Oak Park because there's so much history there. And as you know, our history in America, it was one of the first suburbs for the growing region. And as a result, as Black people got more access to things in certain communities, the evolution of that community changed. And it has been known as a Black enclave, but it changed just like many other societies across the United States. So to be in the Oak Theater, and because it is identified as such, really is what I want our mission to accomplish. And that is giving underserved communities or communities that are looked upon as, you know, blight and not as, you know, trendy, although Oak Park is very trendy now and totally regentrified.
Yeah.
I think it was the right place to go. We will also, as you know, be at UC Davis and, of course, Historic Memorial Auditorium.
What other performances can people take in? Because there's also a literary presentation as well.
Yes. So Shirley Verrett was an iconic soprano who was just overshadowed by Leontine Price's magnificent voice and just her career. And she was actually from this area. And so when we were invited to come here, I wanted us to, you know, highlight and utilize as many West Coast artists as possible. And my friend at Virginia Commonwealth University on the East Coast, Dr. Christopher Brooks, actually co-authored her biography while she was still living. And so he's been invited to do a presentation at the Oak Park Theater, and he will do a book signing at the Underground Book. So if your listeners,
which is right next door.
Which is right next door. How convenient. You know, thanks for Miss Georgia West. We call her Mother Rose. He will be signing books there. But Shirley Verrett was a phenomenal person. She retired and taught at the University of Michigan before she died, much too young, and was just such an incredibly beautiful person all around.
I mean, there are inequities everywhere. I mean, we started our show with vaccines and the pandemic. But when we're talking about classical music and Black musicians, how have they been affected by inequities in the performance world? And because this festival is obviously helping with that.
Yeah. Well, let me just say that all musicians have to deal with a lot of the same issues of making sure they can pay their rent. And, you know, so we try to make sure that when we are engaging musicians, we give them all the accoutrements that they would get anywhere else and treat them with respect. And by all means, you know, get the paycheck there on time, because musicians allow our civilizations to have life. Without music and the arts, we would have an incredibly sorrowful existence. So I have such an appreciation for their talent and the fact that, you know, African-American and Black musicians are disproportionately affected by just the socioeconomic issues of just our society. It affects them even more so when we have things like a global
pandemic shut down the world and nobody can work. So really all musicians are dealing with those issues, but you know, the Black community in particular has been affected in many other ways. And so this is a great opportunity for us to give people an opportunity to do their craft, and they can, you know, make an artist fee at the same time.
Well, Lee, we are very lucky to welcome your festival here this week.
Thank you so much, and we're looking forward to it. And of course, your audience can go to our website. We spell color the European way with the O-U-R, C-O-L-O-U-R, of music.org. And we have a whole list from vocal recitals, piano recitals, and as you just mentioned, the literary presentation and our finale at the remarkable Memorial Auditorium. And don't forget, UC Davis, the Color Music Octet, will be doing Mendelssohn's Octet on Thursday. So we're sold out tomorrow, but the matinee has tickets Wednesday at 2 o'clock. Come see Laquita Mitchell, who did San Francisco Opera's Porgy and Bess many years ago in the Bay Area.
A lot of options.
Yes.
And that is Lee Pringle, the founder and artistic director of the Color of Music Festival, that's C-O-L-O-U-R, which is making its West Coast debut right here in Sacramento this week. We actually have a link for tickets and more information on our website at capradio.org/insight. And that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez, Nick Dobis, and Pauline Bartoloni, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Cap Radio's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow. But in the meantime, listen to a 2017 performance from the Color of Music Festival.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.